and I requested pamphlets from other states, including the state of Kansas, and I believe you might have that pamphlet before you. I want to tell you that I didn't have any psychological harm from seeing those pictures. They didn't bother me or upset me. If anything caused me psychological harm, it was the pressure and the haranguing I got from the doctors to have an abortion. After talking to other doctors and doing a great deal of research and reading about trust on the infants, and because of my own personal experience, I believe my life was never in any danger, yet this undue burden was placed on me at a time when I already had plenty to worry about. I believe this was done to try and convince me to have the abortion. I was told that all trisomy infants die. I now know that somewhere between 90 and 95% of all trisomy infants die before 1 year of age. That doesn't leave much room for hope, I realize, but it's quite different than saying they all die. I was not told about the parent support group for over 2 weeks, not until they had finally given up on talking me into an abortion. Well, you may say that they weren't sure that your child had trisomy until the final results were in. Perhaps, but they were sure enough that they continually brought up termination. I drove 350 miles to see that doctor and was never shown the written information about this disorder that they had right there in the room. Though they were careful to tell me every negative thing they could about the baby, I was never told of any of the risks of having an abortion. There was never any mention made of the risk to my health, either physical or emotional, from having the abortion. I believe the doctors who repeatedly brought up termination probably meant well. The problem comes in where they apparently believe that their professional status or their medical degrees place them in a position to know better than me what was best for me, my family, and my baby, and that simply is not true. Giving life to Isaiah was hard on our family, but it wasn't too hard. It was expensive, but it wasn't too expensive, and it was hard on the other children, but not too hard. Giving life to Isaiah blessed our family, including the other children. Because of his heart condition, Isaiah was always lethargic and sleepy and tired acting, but he was never in any pain. The equipment which monitored his oxygen saturation rate showed that whenever we held him or showed affection to him, Isaiah was aware of it. Isaiah liked to suck on a binky. He liked to hold on to our fingers with his little hand. His saturation levels would soar when he was being loved on. My daughter Emily, who's 5, loves to recount the story of how Isaiah's oxygen saturation level was in the 60s the night before he died. I laid him in Emily's arms, and immediately his saturation level rose to 100. There seems to be a feeling out there that a successful life is one that is free from pain or suffering or trials, and that isn't true. Isaiah's life was successful. We loved him, and he loved us. We've been comforted and encouraged even since Isaiah's death by reading of other families with trisomy children in the SOF newsletter.
Gabby, can you please summarize now?
Yes, sir. I would like for every woman to make the same decision I did, but I realize that won't happen. But every mother deserves to have all of the information pertinent to her situation so that she can make an intelligent, informed decision. I stand before you today and say that if you vote against House Bill 329, you are saying, in effect, that women are not competent enough to be trusted with the facts regarding the health of their own bodies and that of their unborn children. A no vote says that you have no compassion for families and believe that doctors are better suited to make decisions for women and their unborn babies. A no vote is a vote against women's rights. A yes vote for House Bill 329 sends an entirely different message. A vote for informed consent says that you have respect for the intelligence of women and believe that they have the right to be trusted with the information necessary to make decisions for themselves. I trust and hope that this body of legislators will prove themselves to be in favor of women's rights. Thank you.
Whew. Thank you. We'll come back to Juno. Judy Kavanaugh.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Judy Kavanaugh, and I appreciate the opportunity to testify in opposition to HB 329. I believe that HB 329 shows a lack of trust in Alaska women and their doctors. I also believe that government should not interfere in a personal medical decision. As an ER nurse, I know that the standards of medical practice and institutional policies and state laws already require that healthcare practitioners provide all patients with accurate and unbiased information regarding the risks and benefits of any medical procedure. This is called informed consent. HB 329 singles out abortion from all other medical procedures. Even dangerous and complicated surgeries have no legally required waiting periods. This bill requires that doctors deliver a biased lecture. It implies that women do not think through their decisions, nor are they capable of making decisions for themselves, and that the state should have to do this for us. It shows a lack of respect for women of the state and our ability to make decisions based on our own moral judgments. I have the Juno Coalition for Pro-Choice telephone in my home, and every month I receive from 1 to 10 phone calls from women all over Southeast Alaska seeking information on abortions. I can say that without exception, the women that call have thought long and hard about their choices. There's already a built-in delay from the time a woman finds out she's pregnant till the time that she makes a decision about her pregnancy. I spent hours talking to women about their choices, and this bill makes an assumption that women must be forced to wait an additional 24 hours after already making that decision. I feel that it's insulting to women who've made any kind of important decisions in their own medical and personal lives. When I speak to women to let them know that they have to leave Juneau to access abortion services, it poses a hardship to many of them. Sometimes it's a financial hardship, but almost always the greatest hardship is having to leave Juneau, leave their supportive environment, and to add another 24 hours waiting period on top of this provides an additional burden financially and emotionally. It can also delay an abortion and turn the first trimester abortion into a second trimester. The mandate of this bill will not provide better, more informed health care for the women of this state. All it will do is to further limit access to a legal medical procedure. Thank you.
Thank you, Judy. Questions? Deborah Shore.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Deborah Shore, and I appreciate the opportunity to testify today in opposition to House Bill 329. I am testifying on behalf of the Juneau Pro-Choice Coalition, an organization which has identified more than 5,000 pro-choice voters in House Districts 3 and 4. The Juneau Pro-Choice Coalition is a member of the Alaska Pro-Choice Alliance. House Bill 329 does two things. First, this legislation would require that healthcare professionals give false and misleading information to women who are seeking an abortion in an attempt to prey on their emotions and frighten them so they won't get an abortion. Second, the legislation would make it more difficult to get an abortion, again with the hope that women will be discouraged from seeking this safe and legal medical procedure. This bill would require a healthcare professional to show a woman pictures of fetuses and to describe the anatomical and physiological characteristics of a fetus. This is a tactic well known to anti-abortion extremists who ignore issues of fetal viability and try to play on the emotions of pregnant women by confronting them with pictures. The bill requires that women be told about adverse psychological effects of having an abortion. Yet what about the adverse psychological effects of sitting through this biased counseling for a woman who has been raped or is a victim of incest? Incidentally, there are studies, one done by the World Health Organization, that could find no medical evidence that abortion causes psychological injury. In addition, this bill would mandate that women are told about health risks from an abortion, such as breast cancer, when there is no scientific evidence that having an abortion increases your risk of breast cancer. Leaving the details of informed consent up to the people that understand the health risks of pregnancy and abortion. Leave the details of informed consent up to the people that understand the health risks of pregnancy and abortion. Abortion is being singled out for these counseling requirements because the sponsors want to outlaw abortion. The 24-hour waiting period in the bill increases a woman's health risks. Many women, particularly those who live in rural areas where abortion providers are few and far between, like Alaska, must travel hundreds of miles to reach the nearest clinic. Women's journeys are often measured in days rather than hours. With the hardships that these women face in taking time off of work, arranging childcare, perhaps taking time off classes, in addition to having to work with the provider's schedule, a 24-hour waiting period can delay an abortion procedure into the second trimester. In states where a waiting period has been imposed, rates of second trimester abortions have increased. Second trimester abortions are riskier to women and more complicated. The harm from the restrictions the sponsors of this bill wish to impose are felt most by those who have the fewest resources: low income, minors, rural women, working women without insurance or sick leave, and battered women. Many in this legislature talk a great deal of less governmental intrusion, and this would be a good time to practice what you preach. Leave these matters up to women and their doctors. Thank you.
Thank you, Deborah. I got a question for you. You made a statement that the bill would require physicians to make either false or misleading, provide false and misleading information. Can you cite the section that you may be referring to?
I'm sorry, I don't have the bill.
Okay. Maybe Dr. Nelson Asada can help us out. He's okay. Next on the teleconference line. Dr. Asada?
Hello?
Yes.
Hello, am I on?
You're on. Can you hear us?
Hi, thank you, Representative Chairman. Thank you for letting me speak again on this House Bill 329. I've had some time to think about its ramifications and discuss it with other patients. I'm a perinatologist here in the state of Alaska. There's two of us here that see folks for the civilian, military, native, and prison population. And so when there are problems, a lot of times folks wind up seeing us. I know that many of the representatives have their own OBGYNs or family practitioners who they consult. But when push comes to shove, many of whom these physicians are adamantly opposed to abortion, which is a position I totally respect. But I would like representatives to know when push comes to shove, we get those phone calls of, Nelson, could you just handle this problem for me? I really can't say anything to her about it because of my position in the church, et cetera. And so I'm just giving you a little background of our position here in the state of Alaska. I do not come to you as an outside consultant with a political agenda from another state. I come here as a person who sees either folks in the legislature themselves, their staff, their families, their daughters, their girlfriends. And so we see folks who are in a crisis. I see that House Bill 329, we've had patients with, let's say, problem with what's called aortic stenosis, and she's 10 weeks pregnant. She has what's called critical aortic stenosis, where she could possibly die. So I assume I provide this counseling. I show the pictures, the pamphlets, and she elects to continue the pregnancy, and she actually succumbs to her disease. Her family will come back and ask me, well, you gave obviously biased counseling. She decided to continue the pregnancy, and now I'm alone, and I have children to take care of. These sorts of things happen all over the country. And the move has been, at least for health plans, that if those sorts of things, there's a co-liability. I see no provision in this legislation that there would be a co-liability of the state of Alaska if the woman chooses, let's say, to continue a pregnancy if she has aortic stenosis or breast cancer or some other horrific condition that we see. We see these sorts of things all the time, and we spent hours and hours counseling these patients in these very, very difficult situations. So I'm just concerned about the effects of this bill. There are already, as Representative Coghill has stated, there are already statutes on the books here in Alaska that hold us to a very high standard for what's called informed consent. The AMA and the American Medical Association, of which I'm currently not a member, and the American College of OBGYN, of which I currently am a member, have come out against these sorts of legislative involvement in the informed consent process. My reasoning for bringing up the prior example is that with informed consent, that's part of the medical decision making. In any procedure, often the procedure is relatively easy. Whether it's pulling a tooth or setting a bone or whatever, it's the process of getting there and discussing the pros, cons, risks, and benefits that is the difficult situation. In terms of possibly misleading information, one of the points is the controversial breast cancer being caused by abortion. One error of fact that has been omitted is with an abortion, one of the complications is continued pregnancy. I can speak from personal experience because my one and only personal named lawsuit I was involved in was, I think, back in 1984, where I performed an abortion and attempted abortion. The woman continued to be pregnant. She elected to continue the pregnancy and delivered a healthy baby by C-section, and she sued me because of the pain and suffering she had from having a normal child. This was stopped, but as you can imagine now, that this sort of thing is an issue that's a very real one for credentialing and for insurance. So it's sort of in terms of the co-liability and errors of fact, that would be a two issues that I would like to bring up. My other comment is regarding the woman who was testifying about the trisomy. I can just personally state that there's one other perinatologist in the state, and I work with her. And just from my perception, I have seen her spend hours counseling patients. And in no way do we or our genetic counselors ever urge anybody to have an abortion. That is perfectly their right to choose whether to continue a pregnancy or not to continue a pregnancy. Many healthcare practitioners are concerned about the risk of what's called wrongful life, where the practitioners are sued because a baby was born, and of course afterwards they say they never, ever, ever would have had this baby born if they had known all these problems would develop. And so in many cases, these sorts of situations, actually, we wind up seeing these folks, and most of the time they continue the pregnancy anyway, so that's not an issue. So in conclusion, I would like to just comment that, I would like to just make a small addendum that I'm happy to see the issue of the 30-day domiciliary being deleted. I understand it's difficult to establish residency. I couldn't see myself asking for 2 months' worth of utility bills on somebody who had breast cancer and was pregnant just to establish that her residency. And I'm glad that is going to be deleted from this proposed bill if it does go through. I'd be happy to take any questions.
Thank you, Dr. Saad. I guess my question again is based on what a previous testifier suggested, is that the bill would require physicians or those who are performing the methods, the operation, provide false and misleading information. Can you again just cite me the area in which that would be relevant?
My questions and the other healthcare providers that I've discussed to, who determines what's an objective information that describes methods of abortion procedures? How is that decided? And who is going to be making that determination?
Okay, well, Representative Croft.
Well, on that point, is the clinical definition of pregnancy usually a fertilized egg or a fertilized egg that's implanted on the uterine wall? The bill defines it as the second, if you will, after meeting of sperm and egg. But what is that the standard clinical definition?
That's correct, although you can actually get caught several times. I'm actually aware of several lawsuits that are ongoing because women who are going for, let's say, a knee replacement or some other kind of procedure had a pregnancy test done. It was negative. They went on and had whatever procedure that they were supposed to have, and actually the fertilized egg was going on in the uterus, and the pregnancy test or it did some other part of the body, perhaps the tube, and that the woman was actually pregnant and is suing because of it.
I'm sorry, which is the more common definition of pregnancy?
The pregnancy is the one that you mentioned, the clinical definition.
Where it's the fertilized egg or lodged on the uterine wall?
The implantation.
Thank you.
Dr. Saad, it's Representative Cottigan. I'm still getting back to this false and misleading information. In a portion of the bill, it says that at least 24 hours prior, the physician will have to, when medically accurate, at least identify the risks of infection, hemorrhage, breast cancer, dangers to subsequent pregnancies and infertility. Can you qualify to me what that would mean to you, the term when medically accurate?
Well, I could tell you what I do, but it would take a little while, and I know that there are many people who would like to speak. We can take this out of this testimony and discuss it. Okay. In terms of what medically accurate is.
I mean, would you use, like, the AMA's definition or gerontologist's
In maternal fetal medicine, there are a lot of differing opinions or obstetrics in terms of the issues of the breast cancer that's controversial. There's a variety of the other things I consider what is part of my standard consent. Issues that you bring up, risk of infection, hemorrhage, dangers to subsequent pregnancy, infertility, and possible continued pregnancy are part of my standard consultations if and when these issues come up, which thankfully for me are very, very unusual.
Thank you, sir. Any other additional questions? Thank you for taking the time.
Oh, no, my pleasure. Thanks for letting me testify again. But I would include the continued pregnancy as part of the complication because it is a recognized medical complication.
Okay. Dr. Jan J. Whitefield.
Hi, this is Dr. Jan Whitefield. Thank you very much for giving me a few minutes to participate. I understand the time is limited, and I'll limit my comments to two different areas. One is by choosing the term fertilization to mean at the time of the fusion of the human spermatozoon with the human ovum, if that's when pregnancy is defined as taking place. For people who do routine medical issues, medical things such as insertion of IUDs, prescription of birth control pills, and prescription of emergency contraception, this can become problematic because one of the things that the bill says is that if a person performs an abortion without the pregnant woman's informed consent, that the physician can be held responsible or liable. When a person comes in and chooses to have an IUD put in, that by both pro-choice and pro-life people is considered an abortive act, and as such, a fertilized egg as it comes down the tube may not implant in the side of the uterus. So this type of definition of saying that pregnancy occurs when the egg and the sperm are fertilized as opposed to implantation makes such things as IUDs certainly an abortifacient and raises the issue of what happens when a person loses a pregnancy because an IUD is in place, and I haven't sat down and talked with her about the fact that this may cause a pregnancy not to implant. Same thing is true with emergency contraception. If somebody calls and I give them emergency contraception and the pregnancy has not implanted, well, that's considered a form of abortion. And so does that mean that if a person calls for emergency contraception, I need to have them kind of into my office? Do they have to do 24-hour informed consent before emergency contraception? And if so, that decreases the effectiveness and the availability of emergency contraception for people. So that definition is very problematic from a practical point of view. And then again, I will just emphasize one other thing. In terms of the 24-hour waiting period, I emphasized this before in the HES committee. This, I'm sure, when somebody actually runs the numbers, you will find that this bill is discriminating to natives. And the reason I'm saying that is people who come in from the bush to have a pregnancy termination done are going to wind up incurring extra expense in the time that they have to wait in town to undergo informed consent and then the 24-hour waiting period. And by far and away, the large number of people who come in from the bush to have a pregnancy termination are Alaskan natives as opposed to their Anglo counterparts. And as such, this bill, I'm sure, is going to be considered, at least one can show that it's going to be discriminatory to Alaskan natives. Anyway, at that, I will stop my comments. Thank you for taking the time to listen to me.
Thank you, Dr. Whitefield. I got a question for you. Just so in my mind, I'm clarifying here on how the procedure works. If someone calls your office or an office and would like the procedure done, they make an appointment to come in. Do you do that procedure the same day, or do you conduct an evaluation and schedule it, or how's that all come about?
If a person chooses to come in for pregnancy termination, on the first of it, they come in, they go through an evaluation, first of all, to determine whether they are an appropriate candidate for a pregnancy termination. They go through a counseling process to determine whether or not pregnancy termination is something that they want to have, and they're given other options in terms of the pregnancy, vis-a-vis adoption or carrying the pregnancy to term. And then they go through a process of informed consent. Once the determination has been done that they are appropriate candidates for pregnancy termination and that they, in fact, are choosing to have that done of their own free will, and they've gone through informed consent, then normally what's done is laminary is put in on the first day, and then the second day of pregnancy termination is done. By adding the 24-hour waiting period, what will happen is the person will come in and they'll go through the informed consent and be given the literature that presumably is going to be developed by HES, and then they'll be given the opportunity to leave and go through the literature, sort of think over their decision, and then come back the next day to go through ultrasound, confirmation of pregnancy and gestation and laminary insertion, and then come back the third day for the pregnancy termination.
Okay, that clarifies in my mind then the procedure. Any additional questions, Representative Krasula?
Thanks, Doctor. Is there any other procedure where you're required to have a 24-hour waiting period? Any other medical?
Absolutely none. I mean, this stands as very unusual. First of all, and I sent a letter to each of you, and I'm assuming that you got the letter last week. Informed consent is a medical process. It's not legal, and it's a fluid process. And it's an onerous task that the legislature is taking on to say that they would like to help try to define informed consent, because informed consent is something that will change as time periods go by. The risks of medical abortion, for instance, are different in 1999 and 2000 than they were in 1970, and they're much different than they were in 1965. And that's a process which changes with time, and to have the legislature get involved with this is onerous indeed, because to the extent that you have used medical terms in the statute, such as risks of hemorrhage, risks of breast cancer, which are quite controversial, dangerous subsequent pregnancies, infertility, those numbers are numbers which are fluid, and there will be other risks which will come and go as the procedures change with time, because they do in fact change with time. We do medical abortions today and didn't do medical abortions at all 5 years ago, and that's a whole different field with different risks and different medical literature behind it. So it's an onerous task that you're undertaking to try to help define this for physicians. It's a very unusual.
Thank you.
Representative Murkowski.
Thank you. You had said that in the process as it is now, if a woman comes in, you go through the informed consent process. Do you, and I'm assuming that includes her signing off on something stating that she understands the procedure that she's about to undertake. Is there anything in that informed consent that kind of says what you have gone through in describing to her?
The informed consent documents that we have list a certain number of things. For instance, the risk of infection, the risk of hemorrhage. Those things specifically are listed because those are risks which investigators pretty much uniformly agree on. There are other risks which may not specifically be listed. For instance, danger of subsequent pregnancies. The CDC has the largest single data bank of abortion services that have been available since abortions were available in the United States. And the CDC data bank says that if a person has 1, 2, or 3 uncomplicated first trimester pregnancy terminations, that offers no increased risk for her to getting pregnant in the future or carrying a pregnancy to term. So if a person comes in and they have had no previous pregnancy terminations and no previous pregnancies, then the way I would present to the patient is to say, to the best that we can tell, as long as there's no complications of this pregnancy termination, that would not cause any danger to subsequent pregnancies. And that would be a little bit different than the person who may come in for a fifth pregnancy termination. And that particular person, I would say, we know that you have had four previous pregnancy terminations. This is now your fifth, and the CDC data would suggest that this may cause a problem with you in terms of getting pregnant in the future and carrying a pregnancy to term. So the informed consent is tailored to the individual because they have different histories, and the informed consent has to be structured to what that person's history is. I don't know if that answers your question.
So there is no standardized form, so to speak.
There is a standardized form that carries, that has on it things that we accept or expect to have, to be risks that may be true no matter how many pregnancy terminations a person has had. The risk of, for instance, retained tissue requiring a repeat DNC is 1-3% no matter what a person's history is. And so that type of information would be on the form, yes. But other things may be tailored for the person, and therefore that may not be on the form.
The form
does have some information, yes.
Would it be possible to get a copy of that, of a form faxed to us?
I'd have to talk with our administrative director, and actually I'd also like to talk to our attorney, because he gets very nervous about us faxing our informed consent forms to people. But if I can clear this through my attorney and my administrative director, then I'd be happy to fax it to you.
Thank you.
And who would I be faxing it to? I'm sorry.
The House Judiciary at 465-2819.
2819. I'll try to reach our attorney and ask him what the answer on this. If he's okay with it, then I'll fax it over to you.
Thank you.
Thank you for your time.
We'll come back to Juno. Ida Barnett.
I'm Ida Barnick, and I represent Alaskans for Life, an organization here in Juneau. And we support House Bill 329. We feel that it's not too much to ask that a 24-hour waiting period be enforced, because we're talking about ending the life of an unborn child. And before the mother decides to end the life of her child, we feel that she should have complete information on the age of her unborn child, what her unborn child looks like, the risks of ending this, terminating this pregnancy, and the risk to her also of future traumatic experiences from ending this pregnancy. There are many women who have ended their pregnancy who later require psychiatric care because they now realize that they have ended the life of their child. And so we do support this bill.
Thank you, Ida. Mary Dye.
Mr. Chairman and committee, thank you for this opportunity. I would just like to say that I do support this bill. And as a woman, if I were in a position where I had to make this very emotional decision that's going to affect not only my life but another life, I would want to take that extra 24 hours and really think it through. And as far as additional information, any time that I make a decision that's really critical and surgery, that this surgery is different from other surgery because there are two lives involved here, but any time I make a decision like that, I want to gather all the information that I can. And I know that healthcare professionals are doing their very best for me. Otherwise, I don't go under the knife, as my dad says. But I will say this: they too stand to profit from the procedure that they're doing. And I would like the big picture. I'd like the whole picture. I'd like information from people who do not stand to profit from that as well. And thank you again for letting me testify today.
Thank you, Mary. We'll go to Haynes. Sherry Gall.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you very much for the opportunity to testify on House Bill 329. I've joined you today on teleconference in order to express my strong opposition to this bill and to really urge you that this bill not be moved from your committee. The measure before you proposes to specifically and I feel blatantly authorize government infringement on a woman's private decision of whether and when to bear children, and it challenges her right to control her own body. The requirements that are imposed on doctor and patients are not required for other medical procedures, as you have heard earlier in this hearing. The normal informed consent laws are adequate. Please don't force the women of Alaska to fight for their constitutionally protected rights. I feel it's your responsibility as elected officials, and especially as members of the Judiciary Committee, to uphold the state constitution. The bill has problems in its definitions. It refers to a fertilized egg as an unborn child rather than using what are the accepted terms, embryo, for conception to the time that a heartbeat is heard, and fetus from the time the heartbeat is heard until viability. And I feel very strongly that fetuses must not be given personhood in the statutes of the state. The bill, as you know, requires a 24-hour waiting period. This is very dangerous. In the states that have adopted onerous delay laws like this one that is being considered today by your committee, the result has been a steep increase in second-term abortions. In the state of Mississippi, that increase has been 53%. This increases the danger to women. And, in fact, it just prolongs a medical ordeal for the woman. Access to abortion is already so restricted that many Alaskan women must already travel away from home to receive these services. And this additional day's wait only increases the cost and, as I said before, prolongs the medical ordeal. The bill is insulting to women to imagine that a woman is going to make this decision just because she wakes up one day and decides to do it. People approach this decision in a reasonable way. Women are reasonable human beings, just like men are. They should not be treated differently. The 24-hour waiting period also allows the anti-abortion extremists to use that opportunity to follow women home from the clinic, to get their addresses from their license plates in order to harass them at home. And when they're required to return to the facility an additional time to complete the procedure, they can be subject to that kind of harassment twice. I feel this bill is an affront to the women of the state who have, and believe me, intend to maintain every individual woman's right to privacy and freedom from government intrusion regarding personal and reproductive decisions. And the government doesn't have any place in this arena. I feel that the people who have spoken today in support of this bill have every right to carry their pregnancies to term, but they should not interfere with other women's rights, and they certainly should not be trying to do that in the law. Nobody forced the woman with the child who was damaged and chose not to have an abortion. Nobody tried to force her to have an abortion. A person has full choice over who their doctor is, and if they don't like their doctor's advice, they can get another doctor. Thank you very much for consideration of these pretty strongly felt opinions.
Thank you, Sherry. We'll now go to Anchorage, Dietrich Sitcher, followed by Robin Smith.
Mr. Chairman, Ms. Sitcher had to leave.
Okay, then we'll go to Robin Smith, followed by Leila Wise.
Hi, thank you for giving me the opportunity to speak today. Please stop this bill now. HB 329 is an attempt to shame and intimidate women. It suggests that a woman makes the decision to have an abortion lightly. It discourages women from acting in the best interest of themselves and their family. Alaska has had the highest rate of rape in the United States for 16 of the past 20 years. It would be cruel and insensitive to require rape victims to delay an abortion any longer or require these women to view 18 pictures of fetal development. This would also be unfair for women who choose not to report a rape, for women with severely deformed fetuses, or women whose lives may be endangered by carrying a pregnancy to term. A woman must wait until her seventh week of pregnancy before she can have a surgical abortion. This is ample time for a woman to consult with her minister, family, friends, and doctor. Alaska needs to prevent rape and prevent unintended pregnancies before we implement such draconian measures. Responsible sex education in schools and communities and expanded access to reproductive health care are the tools to reduce abortion. There's a story where there are a bunch of people standing by a river, and all of a sudden they see these babies floating in the river, all with the possibility of drowning. So people start rushing out and start grabbing as many babies as they can to bring them back, but still the babies go on. More and more babies keep going down the river. Well, these people are very upset. They don't know what to do. They moan, they complain, but nobody ever goes upriver to find out why or who is throwing these babies into the river. And that's what we need to look at. If we want to reduce abortions, we must prevent unintended pregnancy. We need to address the reasons and not the consequences. Please stop this bill now. Thank you.
Thank you, Robin. Leila?
Hello, thank you for accepting testimony today on House Bill 329. We lost track of who's in, of which committee members are present. Could you tell me very quickly who is still in the room, please?
Well, you have Representative Murkowski, Croft, Curtula, and myself. Cott.
Murkowski, Croft, Curtula. Okay, thank you. My name is Leila Wise, and I appreciate the opportunity to speak in opposition to House Bill 329. I oppose the bill and urge you to vote against passing it out of committee. The decision to choose an abortion is personal and private and is best left to a woman and the support she chooses, her family, her physician, and her clergy. The provisions of this bill are invasive and punitive and are seemingly based on inaccurate information about medical practices and terminology. First of all, this bill is unconstitutional. The Department of Law has already advised you of that. And notwithstanding the advice of the counsel from, I believe, Houston or someplace in Texas, who spoke about federal issues, I believe that since this is, although I'm not an attorney nor a constitutional scholar, I believe that the state constitution
is the appropriate document to look to in this particular case. This bill is inaccurate. The bill uses incorrect definitions. Abortion is a medical procedure, and it is appropriate to use only medically accepted and medically accurate terminology. You use the term unborn child in almost all references, and other people have spoken far more eloquently than I about the inappropriate use of those words. You also improperly define conception, and Dr. Asada spoke to that. Such an inaccurate definition could ban the use of emergency contraception and even ban other contraceptives. Since contraceptive use is the best way to reduce the number of unintended pregnancies and the number of abortions, I hope that it is not your intention to ban that use. This bill is intrusive. By the time many women step into a clinic that provides abortion services, they've already made their decision. They've already consulted their family and friends. They've already made an informed decision. No other, and that is one of my principal issues with this bill. They've already decided. They've already gone through the lengthy soul-searching process and made their decision, and what this bill would do would try to interfere with their own personal decision-making. No other medical procedure requires a 24-hour waiting period for all women, and no other law punishes women exclusively. Abortion, like any other surgical procedure, already requires informed consent. As with any other procedure, the physician and his or her staff convey that information. Are you going to require informed consent for pregnancy? Would informed consent for pregnancy include information on prenatal development, the risk of maternal death and complications, which is greater than the risk associated with abortion? A woman near Homer died a few weeks ago in childbirth, and in the Anchorage Daily News this weekend, there was an obituary for a woman who died along with her unborn child. Fortunately, those instances are few and far between these days with improved health care and improved health care technology, but there still is a greater risk of maternal death in pregnancy. This bill is also inaccurate. For instance, Dr. Cook, the former Surgeon General, who was pro-life, found that abortion caused no psychological effects on women. And there has been no evidence that demonstrates that breast cancer is related to the incidence of abortion. And that is, I believe, the issue that you have been trying to get some of the other physicians to address today. There is language in this bill that talks about describing the increased risk of breast cancer related to abortion, and that is inaccurate. This bill is dangerous. Women in Alaska already face enormous burdens and challenges in even locating abortion services. Many women must leave their homes even to obtain a first trimester procedure, and that creates an enormous financial burden. Imposing a 24-hour waiting period magnifies the burden and allows anti-choice extremists to harass women, making what should be a personal and private decision all the more agonizing. And this bill dehumanizes women, it patronizes women, it shames women. And I urge you not to pass this bill out of committee. I believe that women are smart enough, responsible enough, capable enough to make their own choices and to take responsibility for them. Thank you. Do you have any questions?
I don't see any questions from us here, Leila. I just want to make a comment, though, that this committee has not had the benefit of hearing from the Department of Law on the constitutionality of the matter before us.
Thank you. I appreciate your correction there.
None of the members, I don't believe, sat on the HESS committee. Is that correct? Followed by Ruth Ewig.
Hi. As you said, this is Ann Harrison. House Bill 329 is ill-conceived, pun intended, bill. I strongly oppose this bill as a woman, wife, mother, and women's health care nurse practitioner. Representative Coghill apparently made an assumption in writing this bill that medically accurate and unbiased information regarding pregnancies was not already being provided by health care providers. Since the mid-70s, my nursing colleagues, other health care professionals, and I have provided sensitive and medically accurate information in order to assist women make truly informed decisions about their pregnancies. This counseling is standard, time-consuming, and is based on professional standards of practice. The unavailability of abortions in our home communities makes a 24-hour waiting period, as recommended in the bill, logistically impractical for women. If abortions were available in our major population centers as they once were, the 24-hour waiting period just happens, just by the way things are scheduled. I ask you to listen to the health professionals who have based their testimony on clinical experience, ongoing education through professional conferences, professional journals, and research. House Bill 329 is unbalanced, misinformed. This bill promotes risks of one option to pregnancy, abortion, without addressing risks of childbirth and adoption. And as we know, childbirth and parenting, abortion and adoption have risks and benefits. I want to just sidetrack momentarily to address some previous speakers who talked about breast cancer related to abortion. Both the American Cancer Society and the National Institute of Health have seen absolutely no connection between breast cancer and having had a previous abortion. I ask you that you stop this bill right now, and thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Ann. Ruth Ewig.
Ruth Ewig has to leave. That concludes the testimony from Fairbanks. Thank you.
Okay, then we will go down to Homer. Eileen Becker.
Thank you so much for hearing me. I've been here since 1 o'clock, so I appreciate the time. I am Eileen Becker, and I'm the director of the Homer Crisis Pregnancy Center, and I have given testimony in the past to the HES Committee, and I hope that that testimony gets forwarded on and can move. I'm very much in favor of this bill, partly because I have to deal with the women after the fact. I deal with them in post-abortion counseling and education, and I'm the one that gets to pull together the pieces and help them restore their life and get on with the things that they need to. The women that I deal with have not been informed. I don't know for sure. I don't keep a writing account of where they get their abortions, but they are not told. I think in the state of mind that a lot of times these women are in, even if they are told the basic facts that some say that they give, they're not in the mind or the mindset or the emotional set to really understand what they're being shared. The 24-hour waiting period would give them a time to really consider what they're doing, the long-term ramifications, and to be able to make a better decision. I have yet to have a woman that comes into my office that I talk with, and we talk about abortion and the different ways of having an abortion and what she needs to know. And one of the primary things that I really encourage them to do if they are determined to have an abortion is to get the name of the doctor, because so often that information is not given to the women. They may have complications later, and they really don't have a name or a person to go back to. I would really challenge you and encourage you to get copies of what seemingly appears to be the informed consent. I think that would be very interesting for your committee to actually see what's included in that sort of thing. And actually the time is taken. We're talking a lot of information, and then we're talking a very important thing for this woman to be aware of. My greatest challenge is to deal with the women afterwards, like I mentioned, but it's also my greatest reward is to have a woman come back to me 9 months later and show me their child and to thank me for taking the time to share with them and to give them the options and helping them to get into the emotional state that they can make a better decision. A lot of these women don't make too good a decision. That's part of the reason that they've got themselves in the situation that they have. There's a panic, there's a scaredness, there's a feeling of being entrapped. And pregnancy is not a disease you catch out of the water. It is a decision that a woman had to have a relationship, and it ended up in a pregnancy, and now they're in a situation where they need to make a better decision than they've made before. So I really feel like there are some things about this bill, some of the terminologies and stuff that need to definitely be straightened up. But for the most part, the intent and the direction that it will take women in Alaska is very, very positive, and I thank you for your consideration.
Thank you, Eileen. Amy?
Mr.
Chair.
Yes, my name is Amy Ballenbach.
Amy? Amy, can you hold on a second? I think Representative Murkowski had a question.
A question for the previous speaker.
Ms. Becker?
Thank you. You said that you did counseling for women that had received abortions. Do you also do counseling for women who give their children up for adoption?
We have had cases like that, but, you know, the interesting thing in the state of Alaska, and I'm sure nationwide, is that very few people actually go ahead and give their children up. In the years that I've counseled at the Crisis Pregnancy Center, which has been off and on for 14 years, I've only known of three adoptions. And one of them had been previously arranged. The gal just came in to me for maternity clothes. The second one, she had picked the parents and ended up living with us for four months. And then the last one was a call where I was able to get the two attorneys together. And I was able to see the woman, you know, quite a little bit afterwards. And So as far as a lot of counseling for adoptive parents, there's just not that many that, that are giving up their babies. They're either keeping them themselves or terminating the pregnancy.
Okay, thank you. Now, Amy.
Yes, thank you. I was interested that Eileen is talking about some of the problems that some people have after they've had an abortion, and I'm sure that some do have regrets, and I've met one that has regrets, but on a large-scale study, there was the only large long-term study that I've seen on how people feel about abortion afterward that's done over time. There have been several short-term, and they say that most people are relieved after they have an abortion. But the only long-term study I've read is one from Czechoslovakia, which was done over a number of years when it was still part of the Soviet Union. And at that time, although in Russia abortion was fairly easy to get, Czechoslovakia, perhaps because of its Catholic background, there were several criteria you had to meet to get an abortion. And so this study was done about women who wanted an abortion and who were refused. And they defined a woman who wanted abortion as somebody who had asked for an abortion for the same pregnancy three different times and had been refused. And it was interesting that most of the women over time were able to accept the fact that they had a baby that they hadn't wanted in the first place. However, they studied the children through about age 30, and there were more psychiatric problems, and more of those children went to jail than children of the same socioeconomic class. So obviously this bill is made to prevent women from getting abortions. That's the purpose of it. And I think we have too many problems in Alaska to increase the number of unwanted children. And I won't say any more. I agree with all the testimony from the other people that are opposed to this bill, except for a couple minor exceptions, but especially Dr. Whitefield. I thought his testimony was excellent. Thank you.
Thank you, Amy. Come back to Juno, Barbara Craver.
Good afternoon, members of the committee. Thank you very much for being here, and I'm glad to see that the sponsor, Representative Coghill, is still here. My name is Barbara Craver, and I'm an attorney here in town. I work for a municipality. I think I went to law school with you at Willamette. Lisa, I graduated in 83, and so I think you were a year or two behind me. Anyhow, it's been a long time. So much has been said. I am not in favor of this bill, and one of the things that I really thought that I might add here would be my own reasons as an attorney, since this is a judiciary committee, why a person who might be pro-life would still not think that this was a good bill. Because I think that those of us, and I count myself as one, who are pro-choice, would see this as yet more obstacle. But a person, I believe, could be pro-life and yet still find this bill objectionable, especially if they're an attorney. It's repetitive. We already have Alaska Statute 955-556 for informed consent. It already requires that physicians get informed consent from patients for every single medical procedure, and it says that they're liable if they fail to give informed consent. That certainly covers an abortion. This bill is a duplication of that statute. It goes very far into detail as to what this legislature believes informed consent ought to be in the case of a very special medical procedure. That's unprecedented. That's not done for any other medical procedure. That's been covered here. And I wonder, I don't think anybody would disagree that this is a large burden on someone who decides to get a, would decide to go through with this medical procedure. It's an unprecedented burden. There's no other 24 waiting period on anybody. Informed consent is not defined elsewhere for any other type of medical procedure. And yet, what problem are we trying to fix? I certainly believe that the supporters of this bill are well-meaning people who sincerely believe that the reasons for it. But Representative Coghill said that he felt that many women were not given information, and he supports the dignity of women and the dignity of life. Well, I suggest that the best way to give information is education. And education in the schools, sex education, public information is another way to get this information out. I don't think that there is, though, any
evidence that this is a problem in Alaska. And before you go to the unprecedented step of imposing a 24-hour waiting period on a medical procedure, plus this very detailed, and I think has several problems in the informed consent that you're requiring, what are you fixing? Is there a problem? There doesn't seem to be anything other than anecdotal evidence that women occasionally, and maybe even frequently, regret that. Well, I think that we regret a lot of things in our life, and as we go along, we do the best we can. And I don't think that there's anything in the current law that doesn't support fully and give a physician liability for giving that kind of fully informed consent to a patient. I do not think that this supports the dignity of women. I think it singles us out as people who need special help making a serious decision. And I think I can make that decision myself. I think that me and my physician can make that decision. I think that those who are pro-life can feel confident that women do not enter this life lightly. Even pro-choice women, of course, would not enter this lightly. It's all you're saying is that everybody gets to choose. So I would suggest that even for those of you who are pro-life, that there are some legal and procedural reasons why this is repetitious, duplicative, and unfairly intrusive on women without any evidence of a problem. Thank you.
Thank you. No questions from our attorneys? All right. We'll go to Anchorage, Jennifer Ruttinger.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Jennifer Ruttinger, and I'm the Executive Director of the Alaska Civil Liberties Union. Has the committee received a copy of my four-page position paper on this bill?
Yes, we have.
Very good, thank you. Since you have my remarks in writing, I'll be very, very brief. First of all, the Department of Law testified in Senate Judiciary last week, and hopefully they will also testify in House Judiciary very soon. But their testimony in Senate Judiciary was that this bill is unconstitutional. And I'd like to just, I'm sure you'll hear more from them in great detail, but briefly, I would like to support that position. It's our analysis that, in fact, Casey is irrelevant. The case that was cited by the San Antonio attorney, Planned Parenthood of Southeastern Pennsylvania versus Casey, is a 1992 decision from the U.S. Supreme Court that did uphold a 24-hour waiting period and an informed consent provision. However, that legal analysis is not relevant in Alaska court. Alaska is one of several states that evaluate restrictions on women's reproductive choices under the stricter standard of judicial review established by the U.S. Supreme Court in Roe versus Wade in 1973. Therefore, the Casey analysis and conclusion don't apply if an Alaska court is going to review House Bill 329. And it's our opinion that this bill is unconstitutional under the recent Alaska Supreme Court decision in 1997, Valley Hospital Association versus Matthew Coalition for Choice. And I'm sure you'll hear more about that from the Department of Law. Aside from our concerns that this bill violates the Alaska Constitution, there are also many reasons why the bill is bad public policy. And a lot of the arguments in my position paper have been eloquently articulated by prior speakers. So I'll just touch on one area that I feel hasn't quite been delved into enough yet, and that's the fact that these biased counseling requirements violate standard medical practice and invade the privacy of the doctor-patient relationship. Ms. Kramer before me began to mention this, and I would just like to support her point. This bill requires a doctor to supply all of the state-mandated information to every woman in every instance in order to be safe and avoid liability. The state-imposed litany may conflict with the doctor's ethical obligation to give the best medical advice to that particular patient in view of her individual circumstances. And it's inconceivable how the Department of Health and Social Services could actually craft a pamphlet that would be appropriate for each individual patient in various types of circumstances. So even if a doctor thinks that this information is not good for this woman or doesn't apply to her, he still has to thrust this upon her in order to avoid liability. For example, it is whether you are pro-life or pro-choice, I think we can all agree that it is both pointless and cruel to inform a victim of rape or incest that the quote
the unborn child is liable for financial assistance if she carries the pregnancy to term. Whether you're pro-life or pro-choice, I think we can all agree that it is cruel to remind a woman carrying a fetus with impairment so severe that it could never survive outside the womb that her unborn child, in quotes, will be 20 weeks old at the time of the abortion. Moreover, under this bill, doctors are forced to provide non-medical information, for example, about the availability of child support. This is information about which they may not be qualified to speak and which is totally irrelevant to the physician's ethical obligation to provide the best medical care and advice to that patient. As you've already heard from one of the physicians, the American Medical Association has resolved to oppose these types of measures. I'd also like to mention that this bill is just some of the definitions that, as I understand from speaking with physicians, are medically inaccurate, specifically the definitions of fertilization, gestational age, and pregnancy. They are medically inaccurate, and I think that Dr. Asada and Dr. Whitefield did attempt to address that for you. This is not something that should be codified into law, and you've heard we already have regulations and laws on the books. I just strongly urge this committee not to pass this bill. It's bad public policy all the way around, and frankly, it is unconstitutional. And I'd be happy to take any questions on anything I've said or anything in my position paper.
Thank you, Jennifer. Are there questions from committee members? Seeing none, we will then return to Delta Junction, Emily Joslin, followed by Frances Hallgren.
Hi, thank you. I'm Fran Hallgren, Delta Junction. I'd like to say, I'll keep my statement brief, but I'm fairly insulted by a lot of the testimony that has already gone on, telling me that they know more about, which facts I should hear and which ones I shouldn't. I've been weary of battling doctors who've had their own agendas or biases, and I might add financial interests regarding women and their rights, their health, and intelligence. Women doctors as well as men are guilty of insulting women by giving only the facts that support their idea of what a woman should do in a tough pregnancy. And now I'm not out to get doctors because I've had several that are very good in my life, but when you're in a tough pregnancy, you're forced to see specialists and things, people that don't know you, you don't know them, and we're forced to trust that what they're saying is the whole truth. And I hate to say this, but they're not all trustworthy, and we've heard testimony today to that effect. As an intelligent woman myself, I want to know all the facts and then make an informed decision. And not only that, I think the 24-hour waiting period is essential for someone to gather all the facts, to process and assess those facts before making the decision. I don't think it's an undue burden for a woman to have to do that. It makes sense when it's a decision that will affect the entire rest of her life, mentally, emotionally, and physically. And that's been proven by many studies over the last few years. I don't want to have to make blind decisions hearing only the facts that they decide that I should have or the ones that they think that I can handle because I'm in an emotional situation. I believe that passing HB 329 is essential to protect women from those doctors who advance their own views on women with no respect for their ability or desire to handle all the facts. How do they come to think that we can handle the facts that they give, but not all the facts? They're making their biased decisions on somebody that they might not even know, and then choose themselves which facts those should be. I urge you to pass this bill with respect for the women in Alaska. We can be trusted with factual information, I was going to say that I know that the doctors probably mean well by only giving the facts that they think are pertinent, but even after giving us all the facts, they can still give their what they feel is their informed good counsel and advice. But I want all the facts so that I can see for myself that the advice that they're giving me is good. I think this is a good bill, and I urge you all to pass it. Thank you.
Thank you, Fran. Emily Joslin, are you still there?
Anything, and then you pop up and say, well, everyone
Thank you, Emily, for your brevity. We'll now turn to the Matsu. Karen Vosburgh?
Yes, thank you for listening to me, Judiciary Committee. My name is Karen Vosburgh, and I am currently the Executive Director of Alaska Rights and Life. And this bill is not designed to prevent abortion. This bill is designed to inform women and men and boyfriends or whoever, whoever else is involved in this situation. It gives them information that is desperately needed. I mean, in any medical situation, information is given about the procedure, except not so much in this situation. And this is probably the most life-changing situation that a woman and man will find themselves in. So women and men need this information. Information is not a harmful thing. Information is a good thing, and I'm sure that all of you agree to that. And that's what this bill is all about. The pro-abortion people keep bringing up rape. Rape is a very rare instance as far as abortion goes. It's about 5% of all abortions. 95% of abortions are for, they're for like birth control, I guess is a way to put it. And it's pretty disgusting, but that's what it comes out to. And I know that doctors and nurses are, you know, they're a little bit disturbed about the meanings and the definitions in this bill. And that can be straightened out. I heard testimony when the HEST committee was doing this, and one of the doctors didn't know what the word fetus meant. And I know the pro-abortion crew, you know, waved that around like this sterile little word, but actually fetus is a Latin word, and it means little one. And that's exactly what they are. They are just very small human beings. Now, I personally know several women who have had abortions, and they were not informed, and that is in this state. And it was a devastating thing to them, and they're still trying to recover from it. Women need to be informed when they go in to make this very crucial decision, since it is legal. There will be several doctors and nurses that will be submitting written testimony to you that do believe in this legislation, too. One of the main things is that breast cancer is something that keeps popping up, and it is very significant. In fact, there's a court case going on in South Dakota pertaining to breast cancer information that was given to a woman that went in for an abortion at a clinic, and they told her that the information was not true, that the studies were very incorrect and very sloppily done. However, she came back, and even though she does not have breast cancer, there's a lawsuit going on because of the information that was given to her, because there are significant findings in several studies. This is from a pro-choice doctor, by the way. She sums it up, she said, in two sentences. She said, I have three sisters with breast cancer, and I resent people messing with the scientific data to further their own agenda, be they pro-choice or pro-life. I would have loved to have found no association between breast cancer and abortion, but our research is rock solid and our data is accurate. There is a very strong connection between breast cancer and abortion, and women need to know this going into it. And not only that, I mean, there are over 100 potential complications associated with abortion that women need to know about. And the psychological damages are just unbelievable. I mean, from depression to suicide. The pro-abortion crew says that it's, you know, it's no big deal. But I'll tell you what, the women who have had abortions, yes, it is a big deal. Yes, it is life-changing. Most of the time it is not a good thing. But since it's legal, they do have that choice. The least we can do is inform them as to what can happen to them physically and psychologically, and also tell them about what's going on with the baby within them. Thank you very much.
Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Karen. Representative Croft.
Karen, I just missed your affiliation. Did you say president or vice president of Alaska?
No, I'm the executive director of Alaska Red Line.
Thank you very much.
Okay, is there anyone else here in Juneau that wishes to testify on House Bill 329 other than the Department of Law? Anyone else on the teleconference that I might have missed? I'll pat myself on the back. I've done a good job. Didn't miss anybody today. All right. Now we shall hear from the Department of Law.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Kristen Bomagen. I'm an Assistant Attorney General with the Department of Law.
We do have your memorandum.
Yes, that was a letter that I prepared for House Hess when I was unable to attend that committee. And I guess before I start my remarks, I just wanted to clarify something because the sponsor of the bill, when he came up, indicated that that you might be hearing a challenge to this bill from the Department of Law. And I want to point out the tone of the letter that you received, and please ask you to note that when the Department of Law appears before your committees here at the legislature, we are generally here to try to inform. We have to bring to your attention any of the legal infirmities that may be created by legislation, and in particular to point out any constitutional difficulties. And it is in that role that I appear before you today to do so. And in the case of this bill, most importantly, the focus is the constitutional infirmities that we see posed by the bill. You have heard testimony to the effect of stating that that this was a constitutional bill under an analysis under Planned Parenthood v. Casey from the person from San Antonio. However, the Alaska Supreme Court in the Valley Hospital Association versus Matsu Coalition case explicitly rejected the test of Planned Parenthood v. Casey, which simply requires the state to, in its placing restrictions on abortion availability, to not impose an undue burden. In Valley Hospital case, the court instead adopted the Roe v. Wade test, which determines that abortion is a fundamental right that can be legally constrained only when those constraints are justified by a compelling state interest, not simply a legitimate interest or even a substantial interest, but a compelling state interest, and that no less restrictive means could advance this interest. So consequently, yes, there are a number of states that have imposed these restrictions. They have withstood some challenges under those state constitutions. However, when the case comes before the Alaska Supreme Court, we can be fairly certain that by introducing this test of the fundamental right that was articulated under Roe v. Wade, that these would not, many of these restrictions would not be found constitutional. In particular, the 24-hour waiting period. And I'll start to go through some of the items in the bill. I don't want to repeat everything I said in my letter. I think it's there for your consideration. But before I go on, I also want to talk a little bit about the fact that by creating this legislation, there will inevitably be a cost to the state. The Department of Law generally does not submit a fiscal note when it would be based on some kind of speculation about some kind of lawsuit being brought. However, I think we all know, there has been testimony, at least before other committees, that it is very likely there'll be a constitutional challenge leveled against this legislation, and there will inevitably be a cost. We estimate that a conservative estimate would be in the $50,000 range, and then if we were to lose the suit, then we should have to double that at a minimum. So let me go into the bill in specific a little bit. Section 1. Well, I pointed out in my letter that Section 1 contains some inaccuracies of fact that this department would be required to place in the pamphlet. And in particular, want to focus a little bit on the inaccuracies of the definitions. Now, I'm not a medical person, so I don't have all of the information about what the most accurate medical definitions would be. But the definitions as they sit right now with fertilization, I think the last committee removed conception from that. But with fertilization and conception being confused and there being no reference to actual implantation, that at a minimum what would be created in this legislation is a great deal of confusion in the administration of other statutes that are relating to abortion rights. And with that, I would go in particular to the definition of abortion at 1816.09.0, which then also which defines an abortion also as the prescription of drugs in order to achieve an abortion. And let me see if I can find the exact wording. But in the case of emergency contraception, I think, as also the other testimony you received from the doctor, intrauterine devices, there would be a great deal of confusion in how that would then these laws would then be administered that would leave physicians in a quandary about just what their obligations were under the law. With that, I'll point out briefly the problem that raises under Section 3, where this bill imposes civil liability for compensatory and punitive damages that can be quite considerable for not providing specific information. It is true that in certain jurisdictions it would be considered that this would have a chilling effect on the availability of abortions where providers were uncertain of what the law was really saying, were trying to work with definitions that were not medically clear, and that it would be found likely to have a chilling effect on the availability of practitioners who would be willing to risk their medical practice in order to provide that service.
And you're on Section 3 now?
I moved into Section 3 on the basis of trying to address some of the problems that are posed by the definitions in Section 1 and then repeated in Section 4.
Can I ask as we go along, or would you prefer that we go at the
end? Why just ask as we go along?
Up to you and ultimately up to the chairman. I was looking for the scienter requirement in Section 3. It simply says a person who performs or induces. And you note in your opinion that possibly the court might read it in or might find it somewhere else. But if a doctor is wrong on their estimate of when medically accurate on line 20 or where appropriate on line 23, then they would have committed what looks close to a strict liability crime in Section 3.
Right. Through the chair to Representative Kraft, yes, I believe we do run that risk with this wording as it is. The knowingly only appears here on page 4, line 11, where it discusses as a kind of lead into the requirements of 060, and that is where the knowingly provision could be read in. But yes, it's true that you put, again, the positions in a quandary about what is known, what can be known, when there is so much disagreement in this, just what is medically accurate, what isn't. It may be a changing thing, as we've heard testimony about. And I think with the kind of liability that gets imposed here, the constitutional challenge would, we would probably lose a constitutional challenge on that basis.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Again, because of the chilling effect. I'll just back up since I hopped from 1 to 3, and I wanted to just point out in number 2, in this committee and in other committees, there's been some confusion about just what number 2 achieves, because it is all of the provisions of 1816.010 are set out in full, even though the only change that occurs here is the addition of number 5 at the bottom of page 3 that really imposes the 24-hour waiting period and the informed consent. Signed informed consent requirement. I pointed out in my letter that it could be appropriate at this time to revisit the provisions, in particular 2 and 4. I think the other another attorney pointed this out as well, that there are problems with the constitutionality of, in particular, those two. Number 3 is presently under challenge. Number 1 may or may not, but I don't believe we have an opinion available on whether that is constitutional, but if you're going to be setting these out once again, perhaps this would be the place to address those issues that the legislature and the state has already been informed about regarding constitutionality of those provisions. I think, again, to Section 3, and the liability concern, physicians are already subject to liability for any negligence. They do they do inform and they do obtain consent to the end of assuring that they are able to meet the requirements of sound medical practice. If we can take on Section 4, there is one item I did not specifically mention in the letter that is of concern, and that's the in that 1816.060B sets up a number of prongs that have to be met before someone can sign the requirement. And 24 hours before the abortion, there has to be an oral consultation, and then also 24 hours before an abortion. (Clears throat) there are a number of items that have to be, the pamphlet has to be addressed. She has to be provided with information that she has the right to review. And then in number three, when it doesn't have a particular 24-hour requirement, but then it actually requires that the woman be given the pamphlet. And I would say that this poses some problem where perhaps the woman does not wish to be given that particular pamphlet, where we've reached that moment in her choice. This might better be addressed by making it available to her rather than requiring a physician to thrust it in her hands as such. And I think on section four, the other concern I have goes to the fact that the emergency provisions do not make any explicit reference to psychological health of the woman, and they would be more sound on a constitutional premise were they to contain that kind of a provision. I'll be happy to answer any questions about my letter or any of my testimony.
Jim Croft.
Thank you. Just briefly, Mr. Chairman, I had a different question about the medical emergency provision. The I think I see where it's directed. I'm not quite sure, and I wanted to get your legal opinion on what it does. On page 4, lines 9 through 13, except in the case of a medical emergency, a person may not knowingly perform or induce an abortion without the voluntary informed consent. Then it goes on to say consent is voluntary informed only if these, the next page and a half really is complied with. Do you read A to mean that if this is complied with, you may, in the case of a medical emergency, perform one? It sort of leaves it out in the negative. It seems to cause problems for either way. If it does mean that in a medical emergency you don't have to do voluntary and informed consent, I don't know. Well, how do you read that section? What happens in the case of a medical emergency? Do they have to comply with B?
By reading, except in the case, through the chair to Representative Croft.
Is the bill silent on a medical emergency? It says except, but nowhere does it say in the case of a medical emergency you shall.
So it's correct. It does not say that. However, the except in a medical emergency would, I believe, be useful in saying that these provisions would not be required to.
I think you're right. They would not be required. In fact, that's what it says. But what would be required? Is there any place in the bill that you found that it tells you what you do have to do in a medical emergency?
Through the chair, Representative Croft, no. I don't believe there's anything that clarifies that.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Further questions? Representative Petula?
Thanks. I just wanted to be clear, and that was why I asked the questions of the woman from San Antonio, that under Alaska's constitution and our right to privacy, we have broader rights, and that our court has gone under an earlier decision, Roe v. Wade, in making its determinations about abortion. Am I right in understanding that?
Through the chair to Representative Catula, that is correct. When the legislature was considering a number of bills that were abortion-related in 1997, that was prior to the date that we had the decision in Valley Hospital. And the Valley Hospital decision clarified just which test was going to be applied to the restraints that were put on abortion rights in the state of Alaska. And they did note that it was our Alaska Constitution, Article 1, Section 22, that provided that.
Thank you.
Additional questions? Not at this time. Thank you.
Okay.
Representative Cagio, you want to make any closing remarks? You got the floor.
Thank you. Thank you for hearing the bill. I really appreciate it. I am not a constitutional lawyer, and what you heard was a challenge to this particular bill, so I don't think I was too far off. I think some of the Supreme Court cases that are on the national level, being Supreme Court of the land, would even challenge some of our own state Supreme Court rulings, and I would be willing to assert some of that. But before I end, and this particular bill is about getting the best consent, the best information for a woman who is legally able to consent to an abortion. So I have no problem with that. I'm obviously pro-life, as said, against those who are pro-choice. And that's the national debate. And it is a national debate. And I think because it is, elevating this to this degree is not wrong. Elevating it to where the information, some people call it bias information. The reason they call it bias is because they're on the other side of the issue. And the reason I would put information in there that would show the gestational age of a baby would be the very reason we have the preamble to our Constitution. Listen to this preamble to the Constitution. We, the people of Alaska, grateful to God and those who founded our nation and pioneered this great land in order to secure and transmit to succeeding generations our heritage of political, civil, and religious liberty within the Union of States, do ordain and establish this Constitution for the state of Alaska. And in Article 1, it says that the people have the principles that all persons have a natural right to life. And so I think the state does have a compelling interest to show the life that is being in the gestational period. Now, I know that's a debate that's going to be raging nationally all over Alaska, and there's a lot of Supreme Court cases, and there's a lot of other things. But this body, this is a body of the people of Alaska where this debate happens, as well as in the courts. This is not the court of last resort, I understand that, but this is the court where the people get to have their say. This is one branch of government, folks. We have a constitution.